Now this bill has already been introduced in the SOP, and it will have to take the formal proceedings from the 14th. But we felt that it would be useful for ourselves as well as the members of the Portfolio Committee of the NEA to come together like we have done and be workshops so that when we get into the nitty-gritties of the bill, we have a firm and a thorough background. And I hope we are all going to benefit as usual. And perhaps before we start, it would be useful for us to know who is who, although we might know one another to an extent, but it may not be complete enough. So I will start with the colleagues and comrades on my right. Perhaps the big chief needs to start. It will be a good thing. Thank you.
I'm not too sure about the title of big chief. Could somebody kindly close the back door, please? My name is Ben Dikobe Martins. I chair the Trade and Industry Portfolio Committee in the National Assembly. Thank you, Comrade Sidi.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Bongi Ntuli. I'm the member of the Trade and Industry Portfolio Committee, National Assembly. Thanks.
Chair, my name is Mkungutu. I'm a member of this Portfolio Committee, and I'm in the NCOP. My province is Free State.
Thank you. Morning, everybody. My name is Shimi Chen. I'm a member of the Select Committee of Economic and Foreign Affairs. I'm presenting for our camp.
Good morning, everybody, and both the chair. My name is Lanil Ntembe. I'm in the NCOP Select Committee for this committee, and I represent the Northern Cape. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairpersons and the departments, everybody, media. I'm Soli Hasmin, hailing from the Northwest, representing the whole country.
No money. I'm Zwakhe Sithembe from KZN. In the Portfolio Committee on Economic Affairs.
Perhaps we would do well also to request Comrade Temba to introduce herself, as she has already come in.
Thank you, Chairperson, and my apologies for arriving late due to hectic traffic. I'm Priscilla Temba, representing Mpumalanga in the NCOP. I'm a member of this committee.
Thank you. I am Joel Sibiya from Limpopo Province, in the Select Committee on Economic and Foreign Affairs in the NCOP. You see me seated here. Our chairperson, who is at the same time the chief whip of the NCOP, was not able to come along. She is still busy with the business of the whippery, so she has requested me to stand in. With that note, can we request the department also to introduce themselves? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to everybody and honorable members. I sincerely apologize for being late. There was a confusion about the times. I was informed that this meeting was moved to 10 o'clock. So my very sincere apologies. My name is Mahautam Pashele. I am a member of the National Consumer Tribunal, which was established in terms of the National Credit Act. It is an agency of the DTI. It reports to the DTI, so we see ourselves as all kind of government. So because I was initially involved in the drafting and consultation on this bill, I have been asked by the DTI to be part of the team and to assist them. Unfortunately, the other team members were busy briefing the minister until very late yesterday, so they could not make it. So I was asked to start the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning to the members and everyone in the House. My name is Brian Mutwa. I'm the director responsible for the legislative drafting in the Department of Trade and Industry.
Thank you very much. As committees, we have colleagues who are attached to us, helping us in our work. They too need to introduce themselves. Thank you.
Good morning, my name is Akona Makuze, Committee Secretary from the Committee Economic and Foreign Affairs. Thank you.
No.
Oh. Hello, I am Thoros Naidu. I'm the DTI's Parliamentary Liaison Officer.
Good morning, I'm Lolo Tandos Kaka. I'm a Committee Secretary for the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry.
We need to know who's here.
Good morning. I'm Colleague Advisor. I'm the Parliamentary Legal Advisor.
Good morning. I'm Christine Milan from the Fishing Group.
Good morning. Wahid Patel from the Business Parliament.
I'm Chucky Nodiano, Professor at Stellenbosch University.
Patrick McLaughlin, Southern North American Chamber, and Indian British Chamber.
Good morning, Chair. I'm Denzel Bowman, Neotel.
Morning. I'm Lovoya Sassar, ANC Research Software TTI.
Morning, Chair. You're on Davey on Mutual.
Morning, Clive Searle from Life Answers Association.
Morning, Sully Wolfhazard.
I'm Nadine Annan from MCN.
That the colleague at the back came as a special delegate. Would that be making sense in that way? The one at the back. What am I making sense? That one over there, yes. The one from Khaldin, yes, you call. Oh, I see, sorry for that. Okay. Thank you very much for taking the trouble to introduce yourself, even if you might not immediately remember one another, but we can try to miss the face and the name. At this stage, can we request the department to take us through? I assume Ms. Mahau Tampasele will be doing it. Thank you, ma'am. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. We are here today to present the draft Consumer Protection Bill. It has been a long process coming here. The department went through a very detailed consultation process. I think it lasted more than a year. The bill was published for comment, and it was taken to all the provinces, talking to consumers, talking to various interest groups. It was tabled at NEDLAC. It was negotiated at NEDLAC with Business Unity South Africa and Labour and the community constituencies. So what you have today is a document that has been negotiated very thoroughly, I think, but as usual in consultations, you cannot agree with everybody. So there will be issues that with all the stakeholders we agree to that we will have to fight out in Parliament, and Parliament will have to decide how we deal with those contentious issues. What we are going to do today is to present a broad overview of the Consumer Protection Bill, and of course to request the committee to consider the bill. Why do we need this kind of bill in South Africa? There hasn't been a substantial review of consumer protection issues in South Africa since 1989. What happened in 1989 is that the Department of Trade and Industry enacted what we call the Unfair Business Practices Act. And that was the last time that, you know, there was any serious review of consumer protection issues. And the problem with the Unfair Business Practices Act is that it is a very reactive piece of legislation. It does not outlaw anything upfront. What has to happen is that a consumer has to encounter a problem in the market. Then they complain to the department, and the department investigates the issue. Once it has investigated the issue, we have what they call the Consumer Affairs Committee, which then makes a recommendation to the minister to outlaw that particular practice. And what happens once that practice has been outlawed is that it is out of the hands of the department. The enforcement part of it then lies with the police and the court. So we know what the problems are when it comes to access to the courts for consumers. So we feel that although this piece of legislation offers some protection, it is not enough because the enforcement part of it is problematic. It also creates a lot of uncertainty because business develops models. They do things that they don't know whether they are wrong or not. So it is at a later stage then that, you know, that business practice can then be said to be unfair, which we feel is a problem. We feel that we should set rules that are predictable. Everybody in the market must know what is wrong and what is, you know, what their rights are when it comes to the rights of consumers. So that is why we feel that the Unfair Business Practices Act is currently not good enough in terms of protecting consumers. Of course, also looking at the types of issues that consumers are facing on a day-to-day basis. We also had to look at the South African domestic environment, which has changed significantly. You know, we live in a global world. Markets have opened. We have a lot of goods that are coming into the country. Safety is an issue with regards to those goods. Standards are an issue. You know, so the bill had to look at that. We have a lot of goods that, you know, grey goods that we don't know where they come from, whether they come from there, subjected to any quality or safety standards. So that gap needs to be closed. Consumers need to be protected in those areas. We have a growing middle class and new entrants into the market who don't know how to operate in the market, what their rights are, and how to get redress. We have a growing incidence of scams and unfair practices. We have seen a lot of pyramid schemes that are going on out there. We have seen issues around fiducia, you know, issues of governance, people being ripped off of their hard-earned monies and so on. We have weak enforcement mechanisms and structures. Like I've said, in the consumer protection area, we currently have the Consumer Affairs Committee, which doesn't have any enforcement powers. It does make recommendations to the minister, who then outlaws a particular practice. And then we have an even and fragmented regulation across sectors. if you look at the financial services sector, we, from our assessment, we could say that we have reasonable consumer protection measures in those areas. For example, if you look at the Long-Term and Short-Term Insurance Act, if you look at the FIES Act, you know, there is a level of consumer protection. But if you look at the banking sector, you only have prudential regulation where they look at the risk and fitness and proper test in terms of keeping the integrity of the financial system. But when it comes to consumer protection issues in the banking sector, there is no regulation. You have self-regulation in that sector through the banking code. We are not saying that self-regulation is bad, but we feel that, you know, there has to be another level of enforcement where that system does not work properly. So we are saying that there is uneven regulation. In some sectors, there is regulation. In some sectors, there is no regulation. So we need to create an even playing field in those. We also have legislation that is biased towards suppliers based on the buyer beware principle as well as criminal sanctions. Buyer beware is a common law thing. Most of the issues relating to consumer protection are regulated in terms of the common law. And we do have good consumer protection rights within the common law. The problem with the common law is that it is a judgment that is made in a court, and that is where it remains. So a consumer in the street would not know that they have that common law right. And the general practice with common law rights is that whenever you sign a contract as a consumer, you usually are required to contract out of those common law rights. So, you know, they are of no assistance to consumers because you contract out on a regular basis. The second issue is that there is no enforcement mechanism to monitor compliance with those common law rights. So what the Consumer Protection Bill has seek to do is to codify the common law, to take those good things that exist within the common law and put them into the Consumer Protection Bill. What will happen is that then you have an entity that would monitor compliance with those rights. You would have an entity that would enforce those rights. Because the issue with the common law is that a consumer, in order to enforce their rights, have to go to court. And they have to spend money to go to court. And we know that a lot of our consumers cannot even if they could afford to access the court, it takes a long time. And civil matters, consumer protection issues, are not a priority in our court. And some of the areas are quite specialized that you would need an enforcement entity to deal with it. So that is what the issue is with regards to the common law and the buyer beware principle. The buyer beware says that a consumer must be aware. But we know that when you enter any entity as a consumer, your bargaining power is not that strong. You have a supplier on the other side who has all the information. And, I mean, what questions can you ask if you don't understand the product, if you don't understand the contract, if you don't understand the language that is used to write the contract? So that is why we say to a large extent, yes, consumers have to be beware. As government, we have, and business, have a responsibility to educate consumers and to make sure that they understand what they are doing in the market. But we also need some level of protection. And after that, some of the outlaw principles are outdated. They are routinely not complied with, and they depend on private remedies through the court. For any market to function properly, you need certain characteristics. And internationally, we've looked, this has been the approach. On the side of suppliers, you want suppliers that engage in fair, competitive, and sustainable business practices. Issues of competition have come up a lot now since there has been an increase in food prices. Those are serious consumer protection issues. And the Competition Commission has been able to show that there has been some level of collusion and price fixing within certain sectors of the business sector. And that also proves that you will find a lot of unfair practices that are taking place. So that needs to be corrected, and that's what the Consumer Protection Bill seeks to do. We also need consumers that are empowered and active. And for consumers to be empowered, they need information.
if you go out there and enter into a contract, you need to understand the terms and conditions of the contract you are entering into. You need to know what your rights are. You need to know where to get redress when there is a problem. And we currently feel that the kind of information that is given to consumers currently is not sufficient. So that is why we feel that we have a market that is not functioning properly. With regards to government, you want a government that provides adequate tools and resources to correct market failure and to provide redress without overburdening business. I think in the public hearings and so on, we will hear a lot about the burden on business. And of course, yes, any type of regulation has a burden on business, but also there is a burden on consumers when the market is not regulated. If a consumer who lives in a rural area or any consumer, if they have a problem, they buy a product and they spend money and that product does not do what it is supposed to do, it costs a consumer money to get redress, to get refunds, to replace that product. So if you have on the other side a supplier who is not willing to provide redress, there are also costs to the consumer and to the economy. So I think that what we need to do is to strike a balance to ensure that consumers have their rights, business also have their right to make money and to make profit, but in a fair manner. Consumers have access to sufficient and credible information to make informed choices. Some of the information and the claims related to products, some of us who are addicted to slimming, we've bought all sorts of things. Till within 2 days, you look like Naomi Campbell. And it never happens, you know. And sometimes it's also with serious products that are medicine-related, that are health-related, where suppliers make a lot of claims about the products that they sell out there in the market, and no one is ever able to challenge the veracity of those claims, although the Advertising Standards Authority has been able to pull out some assets related to products like that. So we say that consumers need sufficient and credible information about the products and services that they buy in the market. I have talked about fragmented and outdated legislation. Currently, when the DTI undertook this process, when we did the policy process, we looked at 70 pieces of legislation that protect consumers in South Africa. Because consumers cut across all sectors, from health to safety to communication to financial services and so on. When we looked at those pieces of legislation, 23 of them are administered by the DTI, some in health, agriculture, justice, transport, and the remaining by environmental affairs, minerals and energy, water affairs, and communication. So you could see what the challenge was. Here is a bill that seeks to regulate across the market. But what it also does is to recognize that there is already some level of regulation in other sectors. So what this bill does not intend to do is to duplicate existing legislation. And you will see when we go through the bill, we have already exempted certain sectors that we feel are already adequately regulated in terms of consumer protection. What this bill seeks to do is to close existing gaps, and also to consolidate and take all those many acts that are administered by the DTI into one bill, so that as a consumer, when you have a problem in the market, you know that there is one consumer protection bill that protects me, that I can have a look at. When business does its business, it has this one piece of legislation that it can look at, rather than 23 other pieces of legislation that deals with bits and pieces of certain issues. The problem is that a lot of these pieces of legislation predate 1994. The problem is that those that predate 1994, for example, does not contain the constitutional principles of equality, of fairness, and so on. And those had to be reviewed, to be modernized, to be in line with the democratic principles that we currently live under in South Africa. Some date as far back as 1947. So, obviously, they very old pieces of legislation that don't deal with current issues that are happening in the market.
When we looked at them, we also saw that laws dealing with finance, housing, justice, and communication are mostly less than 10 years old. So the ones that were enacted after 1994, for example, your Electronic Transactions Act, your Financial Services Act, and so on, those contain better consumer protection measures, especially in insurance and financial services, and like I said, except in banking, where we only have prudential regulation and no market conduct regulation, and that needed to be corrected. Those that regulate consumer protection directly, for example, you have ones that are, you know, go as far back as 1976, and you also have one that goes back as far as 1964. So you can see that it's very old act that needed to be modernized. Okay, if you look at the policy context, the policy objectives of this bill is to promote a fair, efficient, and transparent marketplace for consumers and business, to provide a consistent, predictable, and effective regulatory framework that fosters consumer confidence, provide access to an effective consumer redress for economic citizens. The issue of redress is very important, because if you look at all those old acts that protect consumers, if you had to, for example, most of them would not say that if you return a product, you have a right to a refund. You know, those types of issues. Consumers in our investigations and our consultations said they are not interested in a supplier being taken to jail. As a consumer, if you buy a kettle and it does not work, you want to take it back to the store and you want a refund or you want a replacement. So most of the laws don't provide for that type of redress. They provide for criminal sanctions, and that is one thing that we had to do, is to decriminalize these issues and to say that if as a consumer you have been ripped off, you know, you have problems with products, you should have the right of redress. You should have a place to go that is cheap, that is accessible for you to access your rights. So that is very important. Promote better customer service in the public and private sector. Customer service is very important in South Africa. But for example, when we come to issues of contracts, you know, what we've seen is that most businesses in South Africa don't keep customers because of service excellence. They tie you to a contract. So you enter into a team contract, 3 years, that's it. You cannot get out of it. In the contract, you will see that they say even if they don't perform, you don't have a right to cancel that contract. I mean, my security company said to me they would install the security system within 7 days. But in the contract, they said even if we don't install it within 7 days, you have no right. You cannot cancel this contract. So what I'm saying is that they retain you as a customer not because of service excellence, but because they have tied you to that contract. Even if on their side they don't do what they are supposed to do, but if you don't do what you are supposed to do as a consumer, you don't pay them or whatever, you are in serious problems. So it's that balancing of bargaining power that we need to look at. And then another thing that the policy objectives need to do is to harmonize the consumer protection framework with international best practice. If you look internationally in the EU, in the US, you know, in most developed and developing countries, if you look at India, for example, they have a very sophisticated consumer protection regime that we don't have in South Africa. So it's not only developed countries that already operate in terms of the framework that we are proposing. Even in developing countries, you already have very strong consumer protection measures. Mm. And it's also important because our businesses don't only operate in South Africa, they also operate globally. And if they go globally, they have to comply with the same laws that we are proposing currently. But I suppose we will hear that South Africa is not sophisticated enough. We are not ready to have this type of consumer protection because our consumers are not sophisticated. And my argument is that what are we saying? Are we saying that if you are a poor consumer, you deserve to be ripped off because you are not sophisticated? You don't have to be regulated. That small businesses will suffer. So if you have a spaza shop in Soweto that sells that repackages paraffin and it doesn't label it. And sometimes for two drinks, that paraffin is okay because, you know, they are not sophisticated. We can't have that type of regulation in that area. And my argument is that that is not right. That is not right. You cannot have that a type of system where, an uneven system where some people have rights and some people don't. So I don't agree with that argument that our economy is not sophisticated enough to have this type of regulation. We need it. And it is responding to problems that have been identified in the market. So it's not a thumbsuck. Okay, when you come to the contents of the bill, what we have done, like I've said, is to consolidate what currently exists, to improve on what currently exists, and to codify the common law. Like I've said, 70% of the bill, it's not new. It is things that were there, but were located in different pieces of legislation, or they were there, but they did not go far enough to provide the level of consumer protection that we feel that South African consumers deserve. I've talked about the Consumer Unfair Business Practices Act. I've identified that it is a very reactive piece of legislation. It has an enforcement committee that only makes recommendations to the minister. That enforcement committee does not have enforcement powers or redress powers. For a consumer to get redress, they have to go to a court. The Trade Practices Act, the Sales and Services Matters, Business Names, Price Control, Merchandise Marks Act, the Lotteries Act, all those acts will be repealed. And where what we've done is that we are not discussing them. We've taken sections from them that we feel that are relevant. For example, if you look at the Lotteries Act, we recently had a Vodacom issue that was running a competition and consumers ran up huge bills to win this BMW. Some I hear up to 100,000. And the Lotteries Board said that that competition is illegal. We have a lot of those SMS competitions where they claim to promote something and as a consumer you pay 50 rand, 15 or whatever rand, and I know an SMS costs 2 rand if I'm incorrect. So for example, we've taken that section that deals with promotional competitions from the Lotteries Act into the Consumer Protection Bill. Because what we've seen is that in the Lotteries Act, the purpose there was not necessarily consumer protection. It was to protect the monopoly of the lottery. So you cannot have other lotteries. But when it comes to redress, for example, even now, even though that competition was declared illegal, consumers cannot get redress. They cannot get refunds or anything like that. They would have to go through the criminal system to be able to do that. So what is going to happen is that once that is moved into the Consumer Protection Bill, then you have, for example, certain things will be outlawed. Those types of competitions will be outlawed in the Consumer Protection Bill. For example, we say that a consumer will only have to pay the minimum price of an SMS for entering into a competition. So, the advantage with moving it into the Consumer Protection Bill is that now you have redress. You have a commission or a tribunal that will be able to say, okay, this competition has been declared illegal. The tribunal can make an order to say compensate consumers or do something. But currently that cannot happen. The Lotteries Board can only declare it illegal, but when it comes to redress for consumers, consumers will have to go somewhere. So that is what we are trying to do in the Consumer Protection Bill. Sales and Service Matters Act, those dealt with a little bit of advertising. We are moving that into the Consumer Protection Bill to deal generally with advertising. And like I've already said, the Consumer Protection Bill recognizes that you already have regulation in other sectors. So what we try to do is to harmonize, and in some instances we have excluded. For example, issues around electronic communication. We have seen that the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act deals adequately with those issues. So in those sections that we felt that could duplicate this act, we have excluded any issues that are regulated in terms of the ECT Act. This bill was, let me just say that it was also negotiated with several government departments. So that is why you are able to see some exclusions up front. The bill also excludes any matters or issues regulated by insurance laws. The long-term and short-term insurance acts have been excluded from the application of this bill. We have also excluded any issues, for example, advisory services that are regulated into the Financial Advisory and Intermediary Services Act. We've also excluded, for example, issues that are regulated in terms of the GMO Act, for example, when it comes to product liability, because that act also deals with liability relating to GMOs in a different way, so we excluded that. So those are the types of exclusions. The agreement with excluding the financial services industry was that from our assessment, there was, we feel, adequate consumer protection, but we had agreed in the cabinet memo when we submitted this bill that those laws within 2 years of this bill coming into effect would also need to be updated to be brought to the same level as the consumer protection bill. So that was the basis of the exclusion, and you already have you know, the institutions like the FSB and so on that are overlooking that sector. The only exception, obviously, like I've said, being the banking sector. So now I'm going to go into the details of the bill. I don't know whether I should continue or maybe. Yeah, I was just giving a background and the point.
Colleagues, I need some direction from you. The presenter indicates now from here we are going to the details, and sometimes we might need to stretch a bit of our brain nerves a little tighter than I've done. Do we prefer her to continue, or we would like to have some questions asked before we continue? I need your guidance, Mrs. Ntembe.
Honourable, I think Chairperson, I've seen some of the honourable members said we must continue, but there's just something I want to comment on. It's not really a question to the presenter before she go into detail, because I don't think we will come back to this section to ask questions. We'll ask questions on the details as we continue. Please, thank you.
What's the view of others? Is there a contradicting view? Can we allow her to continue, and if there are some comments, as Mrs. Ntembe suggested, we take them now. I see the nodding from my right. Let me take it as such. Yeah, you can take the platform, Mrs. Ntembe. Is there anyone who would like to do the same? I see Mrs. Ntuli, Honorable Ntuli. Who else? Honorable Hasmin. Is it the three of us? I take it as such. Honorable Temple, it's your turn. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Acting Chair. I want to really congratulate the presenter on what she has said, because these are the things we have experienced personally. And I'm so grateful that they went into this issue, because it really needs to be addressed. What I want to comment on is the insurance law that's going to be looked in, say in 2 years time, which really is essential, and I am going to wait for the time for it to happen. Because also when you look to the insurance companies, they sometimes have little attitude when they need to pay out when something happens, and then you have to go to lawyers. In the beginning they don't want to pay out, they have all sorts of issues, but when you go to a lawyer, they pay out with no arguments or no nothing, which means in the beginning they were wrong. So they are playing some little roles here with people. And what about us who cannot go to lawyers? We just have to leave them to get away with this issue. And the other issue that I need, that also came in, which the presenter talked about, is this issues in the shop? Yes, really, man. You are talking the truth. If you go into a shop, we sell rubbish. And I am an MP, I don't have to go buy rubbish. But we have the poorest of the poor. They buy something, they wash it once, they take it back, because it's nearly finished after two or three washes, they don't want to take it back. And when they send it back to the factory, this person has bought it because the person has the need now. Now, those who agree to take it back to the factory, how you wait long for the thing coming back from the factory. And sometimes even the second, third time, there's still an issue or the thing still breaks. So really we have to look into this. And my final comment here is the global issue that they say we are not, or we are developmental country, but we are not sophisticated enough. That really is not true, because if, as you said, if we are sophisticated enough to trade globally, then really right inside South Africa we should be sophisticated enough and to receive what we pay for things that up to standard. I thank you, Honourable Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Madam Tuli.
Say, acting Chairperson. Let me say Chairperson. That's fine with me. Thank you very much for the presenter. And I think this type of a bill is long overdue. But I just want to clear my mind of some issues. I'm glad that my colleague here touched on the insurance issue. I won't go to that anymore. But you talked about information about the product that people buy. You even made mention of paraffin. Now, when you come to page 5. I don't know whether you are saying you are excluding insurance laws that will deal with later, and you also talked about GMOs. Now, my question would be, won't you think that we need to look at GMO food? That is everything that is on the shelf, that they need to be labeled. Because you talked about labeling paraffin. And what about GM food, GMO food? Aren't we supposed to label this so that people know what they are buying? Because there are after effects. Even if we can deny that, there are some other things that will, at the end of the day, cause some hardships for other people. What are we saying? Now, you also talked about the SMSs. You talked about the price of an SMS. You mentioned the lotto. I'll cite but one, Winnie Kaya, which is about 7.50, if I'm not wrong. And lately there was an elderly woman like myself, I don't know whether I'm protected, like myself, who won that 500,000 rand, and she was told that she's old. She cannot get a 500,000 rand house. Now, advertising. You know, so many things have been advertised on our TV screens, on newspapers, on radios, everywhere. But when you buy that product, what are we saying to these people who are advertising? Because there are advertising companies. How are we going to deal with that on this particular bill? I'll ask some other questions when you continue. But let me just get clarity on this labeling thing and this SMS thing. Thank you,
Chairperson. Thank you. Honourable Khasmin.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to welcome the introduction of this bill from the department and say we are going to look forward for the passing of this day, but more, I think, will suffer during public hearings, so that we hear a lot about what's happening out there in the market. We had yesterday. I had my constituency presentation by National Credit Regulator to the communities about the Act and how it protects people and so on. And we had asked them to bring in consumer affairs officers, and they were nowhere to be seen. It was not only at that point, in many instances, these people that are operating in those offices in provinces seem to be not actually out there to work with people. So I would want you to talk about that in relation to what you are doing now, and maybe also explain under which legislation are they operating, and what is going to happen to them. But I fear that if they are going to operate in the manner that they are doing now, we still have a long way to go. It is good for us to enact a good legislation and so on, but it is another thing to implement it so that it actually does that protection which it intends to do. And perhaps you could also say something about your relationship with the National Credit Act, this bill, and how far is it going to go there. We know we have these debt counselors who only counsel after the consumers are in the problem. And in terms of protection, one does not see much that the NCA would do in terms of protection of consumers. Perfect information in particular, which you have mentioned, because really out there in the market, we have this big problem of the lemon problem. In terms of those things that have been given to consumers, there's no information, perfect information to consumers. There's one thing, just bear with me. In terms of this act that are going to be repealed, what will happen to them? Are they going to? Were there some institutions that were attached to this legislation, and what will happen to those if there is anything?
Thank you very much. Mine it's a sort of a way of trying to find out as to whether what I'm going to say will be part and parcel of the issues to be included in this bill. You know, I come from a very, very, very rural area. Very rural. Typical, actually. And canned fish is very popular here. I don't know if it's because it's delicious or it is because people can afford it, but I don't know. But you see, this generic thing. In the past, when one buys that tin, one could see, I don't know whether it's a base or the apex, it was sort of engraved, I don't know which way to use it. It was part and parcel of the bottom part of the can that it expires this, that, and the other day. Now, this time it's no longer there. What they do, they just sort of a stamp, a rubber stamp. You see? So, in ink, expiry date, 12, blah, 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 blah. Now, but then the problem is, as far as I am suspicious, I may be wrong, it's very easy to wipe that and re-stamp it. And yet, people won't be in the know. Can't if it comes the way it used to be, sort of engraved, you can't change it. If it expires, it expires. Secondly, it sometimes happens that people in the bus stops or taxi ranks, they are called in a loud hailer, blah, 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 people go there. they are given some of these teamsters free of charge. Sometimes it is this 500 milliliter Coca-Cola bottle, the plastic ones. So there's nothing wrong in doing that, but what state is that food or because those are the things that in the end matter most. And people out there in those areas have no time for that. The moment you begin to talk about that thing, you disturb their, I don't know what to call it. So it needs to be looked into also, and we have a way of ascertaining as to whether indeed this is good luck or some hidden bad luck, I don't know. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Chad. For the appointed Uhuru from County Economic Development Committee. Chair, I think it will be interesting to know, and one has not really gone through the details of the or the gather of the act, and I think this workshop will be quite helpful in that regard. But nevertheless, the matter of imported goods and consumer protection, if that act does touch on it, I think the lady there would indicate. But Chairperson, I think being the signature of the World Trade Organization Trade Protocol, I guess we are also bound to comply and conform to what is expected of us as a country when we allow certain goods to come into our shores. For instance, I can easily go into a shop and I'll make an example. I don't have any of it, so I'm not advertising it. But supposing you go into a shop, on the window there is written, I don't know what, Christian Dior, maybe cream, and I'll just use that. And you go in there thinking that you're buying a quality Pringle jersey or shirt from Scotland, Oxford, actually. I want to find that it's actually manufactured somewhere without the standard stipulated by Pringle as an international textile company with the qualities that are expected. So then, if as a consumer I feel not satisfied about the quality of the shirt, I can at least write the letter to Pringle Textiles and then be able to respond to that. Now, is this act responding to this question? I'm just making one. You have shops called Hi-Fi Corporation, and I've had many people complaining that they buy plasmas, they buy LCDs, radios, and stuff like that. So, you know, these things are, I don't know where they come from. Quite frankly, I don't know where they come from. But people buy these things, Chair, and later on, when it's not working, in terms of about 2-3-4 months, the consumer doesn't actually have a right to return this particular product back to the store. And I think it's across the spectrum. Is this bill seeking to ensure that the imported goods that comes into our shore actually will comply with the regulations as it would be expected here? And what mechanisms will be put in place to ensure that the goods that come to South Africa actually conforms to World Trade Organization protocol? The issues of international patency, protection of, general protocols that should govern production of goods, maybe even of services, in the interest of, as you say, patent competition. Thank you very much.
Ma'am, would you like to respond to some of these things? Thank you.
Hello. I think it was just a general comment, but when it comes to insurance laws, yes, they have been exceeded, but like you said, it was agreed in cabinet that they need to be brought up to standard. So that was the agreement. Honorable Mantuli, with regards to GMO foods and labeling, this was a very contentious area.
And I think in Parliament we are going to hear a lot from consumers who say yes to labeling of GMO food. And on the other side, you have other interest groups that are involved in GMO production that are claiming that it's safe and it doesn't require to be labeled. And another problem with labeling was that you have the Department of Health, which deals with food safety and labeling. And we didn't want to duplicate what other government departments are already doing. But the issue was that we need to raise these issues so that the other government departments take cognizance of these issues, and if they need to update their laws, then they will have to do that. So I think it will come out of this. Initially, in the first draft of the bill, we had said that there needs to be labeling with regards to GMOs. But after consultation with the Department of Agriculture, I think that is the one that deals with GMOs, they felt that they would need to deal with it because you have a GMO Act. So in that act, I don't think you have labeling issues, or there is labeling, but to a limited extent. So it would need to be dealt with in terms of that. That was the agreement. But depending on what comes out of this process, we can see how we deal with it. But it is an issue. It was considered and it was agreed that it will need to be debated here. It is an important issue. But in terms of the current bill, labeling with regards to, we deal with labeling for other issues. But like I said, most labeling issues are dealt with in terms of health and agricultural laws, and we didn't want to duplicate. SMS competitions, yes, the bill does deal with that. It also deals with the types of competitions, for example, where you receive a letter that says you have won $1 million, and when you go to claim it, you haven't won anything. It's actually some marketing thing for a timeshare or whatever. Those types of things are outlawed in this bill. And we also deal around issues of prizes. If you promise a prize, you must pay out that prize. For example, there are requirements that people must publish which the prices that they have given, and if they promise something, they must give it. So the bill does deal with that. Advertising, yes, we deal with advertising, a lot of advertising, misleading advertising, bait advertising, a lot of advertising issues are covered in the bill. And also the bill does deal with product representation, that if you sell a product and you say it does certain things, it should do what it says it does, and if it doesn't, then the commission will have a role to play in that issue. Honorable Khasmeni, consumer affairs offices, let me start with the relationship between this bill and the National Credit Act. The National Credit Act deals with financing aspect only. It doesn't deal with the underlying asset that is being financed. So if you buy a car, you enter into an agreement with Standard Bank relating, let me not mention bank, sorry, a financing institution to say, you will borrow me so much to buy this asset. If anything wrong happens with that asset, the financing house does not have anything to do with that because you get the asset from the dealership. So the consumer then has recourse to the dealership. The Consumer Protection Bill will then deal with that aspect, the asset itself in relation to quality, to safety, to guarantees, to warranties. That is what the Consumer Protection Bill will deal with. Whereas the National Credit Act just deals with a credit agreement, the money part of it and how you deal with it. As to quality, safety, guarantees, warranties, deliveries, and so on, those will be dealt with in terms of the consumer protection bill. So that is the difference. And I know it is an issue currently that in the initial bill, we explicitly excluded agreements that are regulated in terms of the National Credit Act. And at some point, that was removed. The intention is not to duplicate. But I think what the department needs to do is to carefully look at that transaction. Because as a member of the tribunal, what we are currently seeing, we are seeing a lot of complaints where people have entered into finance agreements and the underlying asset, the product itself does not work. You send them on the car, doesn't work, they can't return it and so on. So you want to carefully exclude, but if you exclude, you make sure that you don't exclude it so that you won't even be able to deal with the underlying issues. So the exclusion of the NCA needs to be looked at very carefully, because the issues are somehow intertwined and sometimes it's difficult to separate them completely, because in some instances you do not have a separation where the finance house and the entity that provides the product are separate. Sometimes they are one and the same, because you have dealerships that also provide finance. So those issues have to be looked at very carefully. The intention is not to duplicate the NCA in terms of the credit argument,
but make sure that this deal is
able to deal with the underlying issues as well. The role of the provinces is a concern, because even in terms of the National Credit Act, it recognizes the existence of provincial offices. Even this bill recognizes that you have provincial offices that are supposed to provide consumer protection and have that reach into the rural areas, into whatever, because the National Commission will never be able to reach up to that point. But unfortunately, for example, with regards to courts, consumer courts in provinces, only 3 provinces out of the 9 have consumer courts. Some have been for a long time in the process of establishing courts. I mean, the strongest court that I know is the Gauteng one that is really doing its good work. But in other provinces, and unfortunately, I think at political level, in some provinces you have commitment in terms of consumer protection. In some provinces, consumer protection is not an issue, some other thing. So I need that needs to be resolved at political level. And I think the bill does recognize, because it says that the Minister of Trade and Industry can negotiate with an MEC to see how they can ensure that provincial offices are well equipped, have the right resources to deal with consumer protection. Because if they don't operate efficiently, you arrive that implementation will be a problem. And that is an issue, and I think honorable members will need to raise it at other levels to really make sure, because the 2 bills does recognize provinces and it does give them a role. But at provincial level, then when it comes to budgets and so on, there are issues about unfunded mandates and so on. So those are issues that would need to be resolved at that level. In terms of the repeal of the laws, all the laws that are being repealed, there were no institutions that were enforcing them. And that was the problem. That is why we say we had laws, but no enforcement mechanisms. So enforcement happened at, you know, a criminal level. What happened is that the DTI, in terms of the consumer Office of Consumer Protection, dealt with complaints related to this act. So the proposal is that the Office of Consumer Protection will be moved out of the DTI and be made into an independent agency that will be solely responsible for consumer protection. Because unlike in the financial services area where you have the Financial Services Board, in the consumer protection area, you don't have a specialist enforcement institution that deals with consumer protection issues. And the proposal is that the Office of Consumer Protection be removed from the DTI, be made an independent agency to deal with complaints and investigations. And then the tribunal that was established in terms of the National Credit Act, their mandate will be expanded to adjudicate on similar matters. That is how the enforcement capacity is envisaged. Chairperson, can fees, labeling, expiry dates, and so on. It is a serious issue. We haven't explicitly dealt with how labeling takes place. What the bill does, it deals with safety in terms of product liability. It is a very, very contentious area in the bill, because it says that if as a consumer you eat that thing and it makes you sick, the retailer will be liable to you for consequential damages.
will be strictly liable, but we do give some defense. Because currently, in terms of the common law, if you eat that skin of fish and it injures you, you have to go to court and you have to prove that the manufacturer was negligent. And we feel that consumers do not have the capacity to prove negligence to that extent, because you have to go into the manufacturing process and to say, okay, you were negligent in this way. What we are saying in the bill is that you do not have to prove negligence. All you have to prove is that you ate, you bought the fish from Mr. So-and-so, you ate it and it made you sick, and then they become liable. But as to explicit labeling issues, like I say, labeling is dealt with in terms of agricultural and health law, so we haven't explicitly dealt with labeling. But it's up to the committee to say to us, you know, we need to deal with it in that manner, and it will probably be in terms of regulation, because I agree, you have some unscrupulous traders who would remove those labeling, but if they do, then in terms of the new proposals, they will be strictly liable.
Misleading advertising of the for example, the health data,
I think it keeps going off, sorry. Well, we haven't dealt with that directly. We haven't outlawed giving people free goods, but I suppose it would have to be looked at to see whether those are healthy or whether those institutions are just getting rid of expired food. But I know I buy expired food from some reputable store, Woolies. But you know, at least they, if they declare, you know, and they proper labeling, and you know what you are buying. For example, my son loves designer clothes, so I go to factory shops, and I know that some of those goods are damaged. But that's the only way I can afford it. But they some of them would label. They would tell you that you are buying defective goods. And it's up to you as a consumer to decide whether you want them or not. The issue is that you should have the information and you should be able to make that decision. Unlike stores that put goods on sale that I know they are damaged, but they don't say anything. So you think you are buying something on sale, but it's damaged. And I know a very reputable store that does that. So the issue is providing the consumer with the information to make the decision whether they want that good or not. But of course, taking into consideration that you don't also sell unhealthy expired food. So that is dealt with in the bill. Honorable Uhuru, imported goods. I think that when you come to protocols and international agreements, I think the Consumer Protection Bill cannot go that far, because the Consumer Protection Bill deals with a consumer and a supplier who enter into a transaction. But what the bill does is that it holds the retailer or the distributor or the importer accountable for the goods that they put into the market. So we cannot stop it at the port, but we can deal with it at store level. So the bill says that if you are an importer of goods, a distributor, a supplier, and you sell goods that are not safe, that are not of good quality, then the bill deals with that, and the consumer is given a right to return, a right of refund, a right of replacement. And also with regards to false labels and so on, the bill does deal a lot with misleading advertising and misleading product representation. So if you buy that product, it has a label and it says that it is a particular brand, and as a consumer you discover that it is not true, then the bill would be able to deal with that issue. Issues around the store, you mentioned around TVs and radios and so on. The bill does deal with what they call parallel import goods, where a company in South Africa would import goods, I don't know how they do it, but you would find that they don't come with the guarantee of the manufacturer. You know, maybe Brian understands it better, but we call them parallel import goods, where as a consumer you would not have the same rights where if it was imported directly from that manufacturer, where you would get your guarantees and your warranties. What we have said with those goods, because the reality is that some consumers want those goods,
because they are cheaper and probably that's the only thing they can afford. What we have said in the bill is that it should be labeled. A consumer should know that if I buy this product, it means I lose certain rights. So it is. We haven't prohibited the selling of those types of goods, but we have said that the consumer has the right to know what they are buying. You have, as a consumer, must know the risk of the transaction that you are entering into, and that is what we have done in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, okay, thanks. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to add one or two things on what my colleague Mahauda has already responded to. I just want to, you know, emphasize more on the issue of quality of goods. Mahauda mentioned earlier in her presentation that we previously had this legislation which was, you know, quite reactive, but what we have in terms of the Consumer Protection Bill now is more like a rights-based legislation where we upfront advise people what their rights are and what they are entitled to in terms of service, and obviously if they do not get that, they are, you know, procedures for the redress. What the bill specifically says here in respect of quality goods is generally that a consumer, when they buy goods, those goods should be fit for the purposes for which they are bought for, and obviously that goes to them being usable for a duration, a reasonable duration, for especially if the purpose for which they were used for is common cause between the supplier and the customer. Other than that, I think also with regard to the issue of product liability, which Markout also stated that it's a very contentious issue here, but the liability here we're extending not merely just at the level of the supplier, but also beyond the supplier, to say everyone in the chain who a consumer may have access to in terms of asking for a recall, be it a distributor or importer, so that at least he can, you know, be able to exercise their rights beyond just the party that they, you know, contracted it directly. Yeah, otherwise I think most of them cover.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, tea, coffee and the rest are ready. Can we suggest that instead of breaking for tea, what we normally would, we have a working tea break. In other words, instead of getting out and having, you know, some sips here and there, we just grab the cup, we come and continue the work here. Can that do? Thank you. And when you come back, Comrade Martin will take over. I have done my bit for this morning. Thank you very much for having been so cooperating. Thank you.
I'm not sure if you have done your bit for the morning, though. But, good folks, just to say that the NCOP is running quite a tight program. This is why the chair would have to go. And then later on, some other members would be in and out. I would like to suggest that when we come back from tea, it's clear from the session that we have just said that the bill is very topical. Everybody would like to say something about it. That being the nature of the issue, if we were to allow that, we'd not be done by lunchtime. So I would like to suggest that when we come back, we ask the presenters to go through the entire bill as it stands. 7 chapters and the ancillary portions thereafter, so that at least by lunchtime we have a bird's overview of what's the content of the bird. But the nature of the content is such that I can only see us pursuing this exercise further, so that members would have the opportunity of going thoroughly through the various chapters of the book, so that there's this broader understanding for members. Thereafter, we did mention that there will be provision for stakeholder engagement through public hearings, but it is important that members do get the opportunity to interface with the various chapters. So let's have that waking tea break, but let's break for 10 minutes, body break. Do what you need to do, smoke, but let's come back after 10 minutes and then resume the business. Thanks, good folks.
Proposed policy and the application of the bill. Chapter 2 and 3 are really the core of the bill because they deal with the fundamental consumer rights. What this bill has done has taken the UN-recognized consumer rights, your right to choice, to safety, to education, to choice, to disclosure, information, and so on, and it has codified those rights in the bill. So the bill deals with the right to equality, the right to privacy, the right to choice, the right to disclosure, information, responsible marketing, honest dealing, fair value, good quality and safety, as well as accountability. Chapter 3 deals with the protection of consumer rights and consumer voice. There it deals with the right to be heard and obtain redress. It deals with the enforcement of the legislation relating to investigations, redress by the courts, and the role of civil society. Chapter 4 deals with business names and industry codes of conduct, where there is some form of recognition of self-regulation, and it is given a statutory backing. Chapter 5 deals with the establishment of the national consumer protection institutions, national and provincial cooperation, which has been raised already. The establishment of the National Consumer Commission, its functions, and so on. Chapter 6 deals with enforcement of the Act, where it deals with investigative powers, offenses and penalties. 7, your general provisions. Schedule 1 deals with consequential amendments to other acts, especially to the National Credit Act, because this bill recognizes the National Consumer Tribunal that will continue to adjudicate on matters in terms of this bill. So the National Credit Act had to be amended to make sure that it's harmonized properly. And then it also deals with transitional provisions relating to the transfer of stuff from the DCI and so on into the National Consumer Commission. And of course it has an explanatory memorandum. So I will take you through each chapter and my colleagues will assist me with some of them. Part A, when it comes to definitions and interpretations, the important thing there in the definitions is the definition of a consumer. Conventionally, a consumer only is limited to the person who buys and uses the goods and services. But this bill extends the definition of consumer not only to the person who buys the goods directly, but also to users and recipients of those goods and services in certain circumstances. So depending on the context, for example, when it comes to safety issues, if a housewife buys a microwave and the microwave explodes in the face of the daughter and the son, in that context, that third party, the son or the daughter, would be considered a consumer in terms of this bill, and they would be able to claim liability. So it's not only the person who enters into the transaction, but also third parties who are users or recipients of those goods and services, not in all instances. With regards to product liability, I've said, it also includes franchisees who currently have very limited protection. I mean, it's one area where it was quite difficult to determine whether franchise issues should have a separate franchise bill or should be some
subsumed into this field. The decision was that we need to deal with franchising issues in this field because the Consumer Affairs Committee has received numerous complaints relating to franchises and the problems in that sector. And there was negotiations with the franchising associations. They have made a contribution to this bill. There were some areas of concern, and I think they will raise them. But I think to a large extent, we have been able to deal with the issue. Another issue to note with franchisees is that the bill does also protect small businesses. So it does extend to small businesses, but in the same way as in the National Credit Act, there will be a turnover threshold in terms of the size of the small business that will be protected. That threshold has currently not been determined. It will be determined in terms of regulation. But in the consultation, it has been put forward by some of the stakeholders that that threshold should be the same threshold that you have in the National Credit Act, which I think is 1 million in terms of turnover. So that is something that the committee will have to consider when this bill goes forward. When it comes to franchisees, there is no threshold limit. So this bill will protect any size franchisee. So there is no threshold limit, but with other small businesses, the proposal is that there should be a threshold limit. The reason being that you don't want to interfere too much into business-to-business transactions, but you do have those smaller guys that don't have, you know, the big muscle in terms of protecting themselves, right? It also is not limited to private companies. The bill is not, the definition of supply is not limited to private companies. The public sector will also be considered a supplier in terms of this bill. So where government provides goods and services to the public, this bill would apply. The only time where the state is excluded is where the state is a consumer. But where the state is a supplier, the bill will apply. Okay, in terms of application, the bill will apply to all suppliers of goods and services that promote or supply to consumers across all sectors of the economy unless exempted. So this is not, because some people have said, we don't see how you regulate the food industry. This bill does not regulate specific sectors. It's economy-wide. It regulates everybody across the economy unless exempted. And I've already mentioned those types of transactions that have already been exempted up front. But for those that have not been exempted up front, the bill does make provision for people to apply, not anybody. For example, it doesn't make provision for industry on its own to apply for exemption. It makes provision for a regulatory authority. So, for example, if you have ICASA and ICASA feels that it regulates the cell phone industry properly, you know, in terms of the same issues here, ICASA can make an application to the Minister of Trade and Industry to say exempt this sector. But that sector on its own cannot apply for exemption. It's a regulatory authority that can do that. It applies, like I've said, to government institutions or any entity contracted by the state. So entities that are subcontracted by the state to provide services to consumers would fall within the application of this bill. I've already said franchise offers, solicitations, and agreements. You will see that throughout the bill we talk about offers, solicitations, and agreements. So unlike the National Credit Act, here we deal, that's not a good example, but what I'm saying here, we deal with before you enter into the contract, when you are into the contract, and how you exit the contract. So we deal with advertising, the selling part of it, entering into the agreement, guarantees and warranties. So this bill deals with all those steps. So that's why we talk about offers, solicitations, and agreements. Because sometimes it might just be an advertising issue where you have not entered into an agreement and so on.
And like I've said, we also deal with any business-to-business transactions subject to a threshold to be set through a regulation. That threshold has not been set yet, but it's something that can be debated. The bill will not apply to instances, like I've said, where the state is the consumer, and then transactions exceeding the threshold, like I've said, if you are a business-to-business transaction and it's above the threshold, it will not apply. And then any advisory services regulated by the Financial Advisory and Intermediary Services Act are excluded, and other financial services regulated by the Short and Long-Term Insurance Act are excluded. I've said that exemptions, limited or general exemptions, may be granted under the following circumstances: on application by a regulatory authority, if the provisions of the Consumer Protection Bill overlap or duplicate an existing law or treaty, international law, convention, or protocol that South Africa has accepted to. The reason why we didn't limit it just to laws, and we extended it to treaties, international laws, protocols, and so on, is that you have companies that operate internationally and are regulated internationally. For example, your airline industry, you know, is not just regulated in terms of South African laws. There are other international protocols and so on. So in giving exemptions, we would the department would also look at those protocols and conventions. If the provisions of the other law ensures consumer protection as well or above the Consumer Protection Bill, and the minister will be able to set conditions and exemptions. For example, like I've said, from our analysis, in some sectors there is an acceptable level of consumer protection, but it needs to be improved. So the minister, in exempting a specific sector, would be able to say, okay, I would exempt you, but you have to make sure that you improve in the following areas. Transactions where the state is the consumer, all transactions that are exempted are not exempted from Section 61 and 62. That is safety and liability, because we feel that that you cannot exempt anybody from. So safety and liability, even if a transaction is exempted in terms of this bill, when it comes to Section 61 and 62, all transactions, it applies to all transactions irrespective of their status in the bill. Now, when it comes to Chapter 2, I've said that the bill has adopted the internationally accepted UN consumer rights. The first right that we deal with, which is not part of the UN rights, let me mention, is just that it's unique to South Africa because of our history, where we have we've had complaints of discrimination from consumers, where they are not allowed to enter. We've recently heard a lot about certain resorts that are not open to black people, and so on. So this bill deals with the right of equality in the consumer market. It prohibits any form of unfair discrimination in line with the Equality Act and the Constitution. Some people have said that it duplicates the Equality Act. Yes, the Equality Act deals with equality issues, but it does say, if you look at its schedule, it does allow for further regulation in terms of other laws, for specifically mentioned the buying and selling of goods. So the Equality Act does recognize that in this sector you might need further regulation, so it's not a duplication of the Equality Act. And what also has been done is that in terms of adjudicating complaints in terms of this section, the Equality Court would have jurisdiction. So what would happen is that the Commission would receive the complaints relating to this section and then forward them to the Equality Court. So the National Consumer Tribunal, for example, would not have jurisdiction over equality issues. So it prohibits any form of discrimination when consumers are buying and in the market. The right to privacy. There has been a lot of complaints relating to unsolicited marketing. You always get an SMS selling you all sorts of things. You always get a call, selling you insurance, selling you credit, selling you all sorts of things. And the concern was not only the inconvenience to the consumer, is that that type of marketing, in some instances, consumers just enter into an argument. They don't understand it. Just talking to the phone, and this person puts you under pressure to enter into that argument. So it's also about the selling practices that those people engage in. So we don't say direct marketing is wrong, but we are saying that it, some consumers don't want it. And as a consumer, you should have a choice whether you want to be subjected to that direct marketing or not. So the section on privacy only says that you should have an opt-out option. So in that SMS, and I think some reputable companies are already doing it, you would receive an SMS and they would say at the bottom of the SMS to opt out, call this number or respond to this particular address if it's an email. What the bill says is that they should give you that option. You should have the right to say no, and if you said no, they shouldn't come back to you. It also gives you a right to register in what they call an opt-out register. Please don't call me register. So you would register your name. So any business that wants to engage in any form of direct marketing will have to check with that register whether your name is registered there, and if it is, they should not call you or SMS you, whatever. So what we are saying is, because in the initial bill we said they should get upfront consent, but most businesses said that would be very difficult to get upfront consent from millions of consumers. So the compromise was that, okay, they can approach you, but they should give you the option to say no or to opt out or to register preemptively. Currently, in our discussions with the Direct Marketing Association, they are already running such a register. Actually, you can register for free, and then members of the Direct Marketing Association can check if you are registered, and they won't call you. And from what you've heard, it's not actually an expensive register to keep. So what the bill says is that the register can either be kept by the commission, or the commission can recognize an existing register that is being run by industry. When it comes to the collection, retention, and use of consumer information, this bill does not deal with that because the Law Commission is busy with a privacy bill that deals with the collection, how you collect the information, how you retain it, for how long, and so on, and all the enforcement issues around that. The department has a negotiation with the Law Commission to say the privacy bill will deal with those issues. This bill only deals with unsolicited marketing communication in relation to opting out. Now, the Part C deals with the right to choose. It prohibits the automatic renewal of fixed-term agreements. You know, currently, if you have a two-year contract, a cell phone contract, if you don't can, if it reaches 2 years, and you don't even know it reached 2 years, you forget this thing, you don't cancel it, it continues to run. So what this bill says is that there cannot be automatic. Some would renew for the full term without consulting you. So what the bill says is that it prohibits automatic renewal of fixed-term agreements. It imposes an obligation on the supplier to inform you. Are we not sure? To inform you.
As long as it's not information sharing.
We are. This bill is going to deal with escrow. Anyway. So, what happens is that if your contract then reaches an expiry date after that 3 years, they cannot automatically renew for the full term. It can run on a month-to-month basis. They are under obligation to inform you of the expiry, and you have to give them consent to continue with it. Right? It requires codes for maintenance and repair services. We've had a lot of complaints where consumers taking their car for a service, and they tell them it will only be 100 rand. You come back, they say it's 10,000. And because we have your car, we keep it. You know, you can't pay us the 10,000, we keep your car. So what this says is that they must give you a quotation, you must authorize the amount, but you can also pre-authorize that, okay, you can go up to a certain amount up front, and if they have to do anything else beyond what you have agreed to, they have to come back to you and you have to authorize again. So it protects a lot. We've seen a lot of complaints in this area. It provides for a 5-day cooling off for direct marketing. This is standard, it has always been there, where if you as a consumer do not voluntarily go to an institution to say, I want this thing, somebody comes to your home or they call you on the phone and so on, it gives you a 5-day cooling off period for direct marketing and where you did not initiate the transaction. It also provides for the right to return goods and receive refunds within 15 days. So if you buy something, you are not happy with it, it's not doing what it's supposed to do, you have the right to return it and you have the right to receive a refund. That is under the right to choose. Part D, under disclosure and information, it facilitates access to simple and transparent contracts and improves disclosure by giving the consumer the right to information in plain and understandable language. In the National Credit Act, there was a requirement that consumers should receive documents in an official language of their choice. That same requirement was in the initial draft of this bill. After consultation, it was taken out. And it's something we agreed that should be debated in this forum, in the public hearings, and the committees will have to make a decision. Because the difference with the National Credit Act, it was one transaction, one credit agreement, mostly. Here, it's across the economy, it's millions of transactions. And the issue was, well, how would that impact on business in terms of cost, in terms of propriety? Some businesses are already doing it as a competitive thing. I mean, some you go to some NTMs, you find all the languages. But imagine providing all these documents in all different official languages or in certain official languages. And then the regional issues also came into being. Now people are saying, okay, in the Western Cape, then we will demand this language and that language. In that province, we will demand that language and that language. And we felt that economy-wise, the impact might quite be substantial. But so what was required is that it should be in plain and understandable language. And some people were also saying, I mean, it doesn't matter whether it can be in Zulu, but difficult Zulu, because that's Zulu that is difficult. So it depends on how that contract is written. It doesn't matter what language. If you are made to understand and it's not written in legalese, you know, the font is big enough, all the essential things are pointed out to you, then that is important. But I'm pointing it out as an issue that the committee would need to note with regards to official language requirements. But it is in the National Credit Act in this bill, because of the scope of this bill, that requirement was taken out. But the plain and understandable language issues remain. It also requires the compulsory display of prices and the provision of transaction records. Currently, it's not compulsory to display a price, so you'll find very fancy boutiques that you go in and there's no price. You have to ask. I don't go into those because I'm very embarrassed to ask what the price is. But the issue has been that some people feel that because there is no price display, you are charged according to how you look, you know, or how you are dressed or whatever. I actually experienced that in the street. It happened. I braid my hair sometimes in Joburg in the street. And I made a mistake of parking my car in front of those women. And they fleeced me. No, it's just 200 rand. And some other person came around and said, what for you, 50 rand? So I could see that, okay, so this is a problem. So the bill requires compulsory display of prices, But in recognition of those situations, for example, you know, in a flea market, sometimes you have to haggle and negotiate prices, they are not displayed. It does provide for the minister to exempt in certain situations. So it's not exempted upfront, but it does provide for the minister, for example, flea markets. And it doesn't even dictate how you must display the price. You can write it on a box, it's fine, as long as consumers can see how much they are up for. It also requires the provision of transaction records. That is very important because a lot of the time when consumers come with complaints and they have no transaction records, you cannot prove whether they actually bought that item from that particular person or not. And this is a requirement. And this is one area where business has said it will have a negative impact on small businesses because of that requirement. But that requirement doesn't also say, it does say what information must be on the transaction records, but it doesn't say it has to be typed. You know, for example, it doesn't say it has to be electronic. You can write it down on a piece of paper and sign it, as long as the consumer has proof. For example, when it comes to liability issues, they have to prove that they bought the product from that person. So if there's no transaction record, then it becomes a problem. So there is a compulsory requirement. When it comes to labeling, like I've said, we've taken out a lot of issues of labeling. There were certain sections required around labeling and so on. In the negotiations with Netflix, those were taken out. The only issues that remain around labeling is that whenever you put a label on a product, it should, or a trade description, something that describes that this is mineral water, you know, it was taken from some whatever, that should not be misleading. So if a consumer finds out you claim that this is mineral water, you got it from some oasis somewhere, and that is not true, that would be misleading. So it prohibits any type of labeling that would be misleading to the consumer and any trade description. Part E deals with fair and responsible advertising, marketing, and promotion. It prohibits unfair marketing practices, and there is a lot of those types of marketing practices. The first example is bait advertising. You would usually find that most stores, even some very big one I know, would advertise that they have certain things in stock at a certain price. You go there, it's never in stock. You never find those things available at that price. What usually happens, you go in there and you find a very clever salesman who says, no, but you know, we have this one. So the issue was just to get you to the store, that is to bait you. So the commission would be able to investigate whether they actually had those products in stock or whether it was just a misleading thing for consumers. Another controversial one, which I think the committee will hear from the timeshare industry, I think, would be referral selling. The bill prohibits referral selling only where, for example, if somebody says, if you buy something from me and you bring a friend, I will give you a discount. We are fine with that. So Tupperware is not under threat here, it's fine, it can operate, because if they say, if you do a party, we want to give you a present, you'll get your present. The only thing the bill prohibits is when getting that prize depends on the parties that you are recruiting joining the system. Because the problem here is all these multi-level marketing schemes, where some of them are disguised as pyramid schemes, where it says, bring two friends, but they must join. Not only they can come and look at the product, and that's fine, it's up to them whether they want them or not. So the bill prohibits referral selling only where the condition for getting the price or the discount or whatever depends on the other people joining. And I think this is also a contentious one, because that's how some industries operate. For example, in your timeshare industry and other stuff. Another form of marketing practice that is prohibited in the bill is negative option marketing. Negative option marketing is where they send you a credit card and say, if you don't bring it back within 14 days, we assume you want it.
and it means automatically you have entered into a transaction. They send you a book. If you don't return it, and at your own cost, remember. So the bill says no negative option marketing in terms of goods or services or contracts. That is outright prohibited. And then another issue that I've also talked about is that it regulates promotional competition. So the issues that we've talked about around SMSs and those letters that says you've won a million, when you get there, it's something else, you never get the prize, and all of those things, quite problematic from the complaints that we've seen. That is not prohibited, but it's regulated. For example, it says that if they advertise that people will get a specific price, you must get that specific. Those letters that says you've won a million or whatever, those are prohibited in the bill. And then there are issues around publishing the rules of the competition. There are issues, there's one that says you can only enter at, for example, if it's an SMS, it has to be at the normal price of an SMS. So you cannot have those competitions, promotional competitions that say 20 rand to enter when an SMS is 2 rand and so on. So the bill does regulate promotional competitions. Customer loyalty program. It has been an issue also, quite controversial, because what the bill says is that if, for example, you are a member of a loyalty program, it has been an issue in the airline industry, you get points. Once you get points, in terms of that loyalty program, you are promised that you can get a ticket. And most of the time, you never get a seat. There are always stories about what has happened. So the bill says, if you enter into a loyalty, it's not only the airline industry, everybody runs a loyalty program these days. Hotels, you know, after so many points, you get free accommodations and so on. What the bill says is that loyalty credits should be treated as currency. So if you have loyalty credits in your hand, you have rent. And if you go and buy, you should not be discriminated against. So there's been an issue that, for example, in the airline industry, a certain number of seats would be set aside for the loyalty guys, and sometimes you cannot get a seat. So that is prohibited in the bill. But what the bill does in order to try and accommodate those other industries, because we negotiated with them, it was agreed that they can have, I think, a maximum of 3 months in the year where they can block out loyalty customers to say, okay, peak periods maybe. But the other 9 months of the year, there should be no discrimination. And another issue is that if they promise you that if you have so many points, you get this product, they must give you this product, nothing else. But you cannot go back and say, no, we don't have H2O, now we have something else of an inferior quantity and so on. So the bill regulates those loyalty programs. Part F, fair and honest dealing. It prohibits false, misleading, and deceptive representation. This is a general prohibition, catch-all. So where the bill has not specifically dealt with an issue, it can be captured under that prohibition, where it prohibits false, misleading, and deceptive representations with regard to products or services. So anything that is misleading or is false would be dealt with in terms of this bill. For example, products that promise you all sorts of miracles and then they don't happen, a consumer would be able to take that issue to the commission. It prohibits overselling and overbooking. Unfortunately, this is another example in the airline industry. I'm highlighting this industry so that when they come here, the committee already knows what to expect from which sector. Overselling and overbooking is another issue in the airline industry. You buy your ticket, you get there. Sorry, madam, you cannot get in because you've overbooked. That is to make provision for the airlines say for no-shows. So as a consumer, you get there, the plane carries 50 people, they sell 60 tickets.
so 10 people can be turned away to say. It happens in concerts where people know that a stadium can only take 50 people, they sell 1,000 tickets. So that is to deal with that. And what the bill says, you cannot do that. No, it doesn't prohibit it. But it says that where people oversell or overbook, the consumer has to be refunded the price of that ticket with interest and consequential damages. And that is the contentious part. Because the airline industry was saying, what if we bump you off and you are going to enter into a $1 million agreement somewhere you could not make it? Does it mean you can sue the airline for that loss of income or whatever? So it's still one area that has to be looked at. And we had a conference recently where the industry showed us models, compensation models internationally to say, for example, they have to refund you the ticket. If you had to incur costs, for example, you didn't intend sleeping over and you had to go into a hotel, they'd have to compensate you for those. So they'd have to compensate you for direct damages linked to their breach of contract, not to consequential damages. So that is one issue that is currently being debated, but as it stands now in the business, yes, the harm suffered. So it's still there, but it's quite contentious. So it's one thing that will come up in the hearing. Unconscionable conduct, that is one difficult word, unconscionable. It's quite a catch-all kind of term. What it deals with, you know, the type of practice that is quite morally wrong if you look at it. And it's quite broad, so it will capture a lot of issues. For example, we've seen in some sectors where a pensioner who's 80 years old would be sold, you know, an insurance product that has a 20-year kind of lifetime. So it's sort of doing things that are morally wrong in terms of how you deal with consumers. So, I mean, pensioners have been targeted in terms of unconscionable conduct, and I'm sure my colleagues can give other examples, please. The right to fair, just, and reasonable terms and conditions. This section prohibits unfair, unreasonable, or unjust contract terms. For example, this bill prohibits any contracting out. So if you enter into a contract with a supplier, they cannot have a clause in their contract that says that you give away your rights in terms of this bill. Because currently that's what happens a lot. Most consumers sign away their common law rights. They contract out of the common law. So you would enter into a contract that says if this happens, you would not have this right, even though you have that right in terms of the law. So this bill prohibits any type of contracting out. And then it looks at unreasonable contract terms. So unreasonable, I mean, that is something that the court would have to look at, whether a term is unreasonable or not. And there are certain things that they would look at. Mostly they would look at bargaining power, the bargaining power of the consumer. Because the issue with unreasonable and unjust contract terms is that most of the contracts that we enter into are standard contracts for everybody. So as a consumer, you really have an opportunity to negotiate a contract. If you hire a car, it's the same contract for everybody. And most of the time, you cannot say, no, I don't agree to that, I don't agree to it, because it's standard. And sometimes, like me yesterday, I got here at 11 o'clock at night, standing in a queue, you don't even read the contract. They already have crosses. 1, 2, 3. Then you sign away your life. But those are the issues some terms would be taken out. There are other suggestions that we should have some type of gray list that lists all the terms that a supplier can have in their contract, but they can go and justify
to the commission or the court whether the contract terms are fair or not. It requires consumers to be given 3 copies of a contract. This is one thing we've seen. A lot of consumers are not given contracts, where they just go and buy. Somebody sitting on the other side, it's sign here, they keep the contract. When there are problems, a consumer does not have a contract in hand. So the bill requires every consumer, gives them a right to have a copy of the contract, because that is important when they have to obtain redress. It also outlaws unilateral changes to contracts. So any change to a contract will have to be negotiated with you and you will have to agree to it. So a supplier cannot just unilaterally change the terms of the contract without negotiating them with you. It outlaws certain types of agreements. For example, agreements that are entered into with minors, negative options. For example, if you enter into a contract as a result of something that is already prohibited in terms of the bill, that contract is void. For example, the bill prohibits negative option marketing. So if somebody sends you an item and says within 14 days, return, if you don't, then you've automatically entered into that contract. That contract would not be recognized in terms of this bill because it was entered into through something that was already prohibited. I've already said that the bill outlaws any form of contracting out, so you cannot give away your rights as is currently the practice when it comes to common law rights. Okay, and then Part 8 deals with the right to fair value, good quality, and safety. That is where we come to the quality of goods and services. The bill facilitates access to quality service, safe goods and services and redress by providing statutory warranties for safety and quality. Like my colleague Brian has said, the bill says that if you buy something, it must be fit for purpose. It must be safe and it must be of good quality. So the consumer in this instance would be able, for example, to return. They would have statutory warranties. So even where they don't give you a warranty to say this product is good, this bill gives you a general right to buy goods or contract services that are safe and of good quality. It also introduces a general product safety monitoring and recall regime. Currently in some sectors, I think in health, you have a recall regime, for example, if you have medicines that, I think in health where you have products that are not safe, Okay, my colleagues are saying a recent examples of condoms that were not safe, those were recalled. But in some sectors, you don't have a recall regime. For example, what the bill now requires is, for example, it requires most suppliers to keep, in some sectors, to keep records of complaints. For example, in your vehicle, motor car industry, you know, you would be required to keep a record of complaints, so you see that a certain model has certain problems. And what the commission can do is to inspect those records, and if the manufacturer does not voluntarily recall those goods, the commission is given the power to order a recall of unsafe goods. So they also have the commission would also have a monitoring capacity to monitor the market and see what goods are safe or not. And I suppose that can answer the initial questions about imported goods and so on. So the commission would be able to monitor the market and identify products that they feel are not safe. Not that they feel, of course, they will have to test and so on. So some testing facilities would be required and they would be able to recall those goods and take them out of the market and provide redress. And the question was that how does that relate to the role of the SABS when it comes to standards? The role of the SABS is to set
standards, and some of them are not compulsory. You have compulsory standards and you have voluntary standards. And when it comes to redress, they are not responsible for redress. For example, if there is a certain standard and you have somebody who doesn't comply with that standard, all the SABF can do is to take that product out of the market. But what this bill does is that it takes it further and makes it possible for consumers to obtain the redress. For example, through product liability and so on. So that's how different it is. But this bill would not set technical standards. Technical standards would remain the jurisdiction of the SABF. What it can do is it has a monitoring function where, for example, maybe there is no standard and they can deal with issues of complaints relating to the quality and safety. But it doesn't set technical standards. But it has a general requirement to say any good that comes to the market must comply with a standard where it exists. But then if there are enforcement issues relating to that, then the relevant entity would deal with that. But the general requirement is that goods that come into the market must be safe and of good quality. The one that I've said is quite controversial is that this bill extends liability to retailers. Currently, in terms of the common law, liability only applies mainly to manufacturers. I think for retailers, it's only where they claim to be experts in a particular area. For example, if somebody runs a bicycle shop and they claim to be experts on bicycles, then in terms of the current regime, they can be subject to liability. The big difference with this bill is that currently, in terms of the common law, if you are injured by a product or whatever, if you have to prove fault. You have to prove that the manufacturer was negligent in producing that product and that led to you being injured. The difference in this bill is that it says that you do not have to prove fault. You have to prove that you bought the product from that person and it injured you. So it extends it to the retailer. And the argument from the department is that why it is extended to the retailer is that first, the retailer cannot bring goods into the market and not take responsibility for the quality and safety of those goods. Most responsible retailers would have an agreement with their suppliers that you must supply with me with this quality of food. So they just don't go out there and take anything and sell it. But the other argument is that this would impose an unfair burden on many businesses because they are not responsible for manufacturing, just selling. Then it means that it would be an unfair burden on them, but that is something that would have to be debated. Because the other issue is that here we see that the retailer has the bargaining power to go after the manufacturer, to say, you sold me goods that were substandard and I had to incur these liabilities for consumers. And the retailer can claim from the manufacturer and they have the ability to do that. But for a consumer to chase after a manufacturer who in some instances doesn't even reside in South Africa, is quite problematic because sometimes the retailer is the middleman. So who should the consumer have recourse to when they have a problem when it comes to liability issues? But like I've said, this is one area where there will be big debate and we've agreed that it should be like that. And the liability that people would be responsible for is illness, injury, and damage to property, as well as death as a result of the defective goods, as well as improper labeling. So we are also saying that if you label, you must give, if you have a product and it's dangerous, you must give instructions of use that are proper, that will make sure that the consumer can safely use that that product. But in order to mitigate the negative consequences that businesses said this section would have on them, the bill does provide for statutory defenses. So a retailer can still go and try and use the statutory defenses in the bill to say, for example, looking at how, whether they were in selling that product or manufacturing that product, they were complying with some form of regulation. For example, if you have to comply with a certain standard and that thing doesn't work out, it's not your fault because you were complying with a legal requirement in manufacturing that product. So there would be those types of defenses. For example, looking at your role in the marketing of that product and so on. So several statutory defenses are provided in the bill to make sure that it is balanced out. It's not completely on the side of the consumer. Okay. Chapter 3 deals with the protection of consumers' rights and consumers' voice. It gives consumers the right to be heard and obtain redress. For example, it prevents suppliers from discriminating, intimidating or penalizing consumers who seek to enforce their rights. This deals with the issue where a lot of times we've had consumers saying, I went to that store to complain, either they were chased out or in some instances beaten up and things like that. So this section would prevent that type of intimidation. It says that a consumer has the right to complain, and if they complain, there must be a complaint resolution system within that business to deal with that complaint. So they should not be intimidated or penalized. It provides for various access points for consumers to lodge complaints. Currently, the way the bill stands is that if you have a complaint, you have to go to your supplier. But some consumers are afraid to do that. So the commission will be able to receive complaints and negotiate on behalf of the consumer with the supplier. And the reality of the market is that currently we have industry complaints resolution mechanisms. In some sectors, you have an ombudsman. For example, in the motor car industry, you have the motor car industry ombudsman. In the banking sector, you have the banking adjudicator and so on. You have the advertising standards authority. You have the furniture traders association and so on. So, I mean, some sectors have recognized the importance of providing consumers with redress, and this bill recognizes those institutions. It says that consumers can use those forums, and it provides for a system of recognizing and accrediting those schemes, for example, in the same way that the FISOS Act, the Financial Intermediary Services Ombudsman's Act. So that act does provide for a recognition of schemes. For example, it does recognize schemes that, like the banking adjudicator, your short-term insurance ombudsman, and so on. So this bill would also use those services, because it is important that industry takes part in the consumer and the complaints resolution process, because they know the products, they know the system, they are experts in that area, and we acknowledge that they can do it much quicker. It is only where, for example, consumers are not happy at that level, then they can escalate to the commission, which can then do a formal investigation and then prosecute the matter either through the court or the consumer tribunal. But we think that the commission should not focus on dealing with small complaints, individual complaints, where the supplier or the industry mechanism can deal with it much quicker. What the commission should do should enforce in those areas where there are systematic problems, where there are serious issues in the market. The commission should be able to investigate and enforce, rather than deal with individual complaints that can be dealt with in terms of alternative dispute resolution.
Let me give you a chance to catch your breath. I think earlier on you did meet the brief to give members an indication as to what to expect in the other chapters. But I'd like to suggest that you also, in your brief, mentioned that chapters 2 and 3 are the cardinal most important chapters. You have dealt extensively with chapter 2. perhaps it would be propitious right now to afford members the opportunity to pose questions and make comments with regard to Chapter 2 specifically, so that by the time we reach lunchtime, we have at least dealt with this. Tomorrow when we resume business, then you can proceed with Chapter 3.
Okay.
But the important aspect is that this morning we did get the general overview and background as to why we have this bill as it is before us. So, members, your opportunity for comments and questions. And then, Mahau, it would also enable your colleagues to earn their keep. thank you. Ma'am? Your question, comment?
Thank you, Chairperson. Does the bill provide for not all the rights, but at least the basics to be placed onto the shops for customers to see this is your right, that is your right? And I just make a quick example. I know we are against time, that when the price is labeled onto a garment, and then the price was supposed to be changed, but at that moment when you are busy buying, the price has not been changed. Now they will tell you, but the price has been changed, whereas you have seen this price. So that sort of thing, and then they expect you to pay the higher price, whereas you have seen the lower price. Thank you very much.
Thank you. May I just make a general point? We are dealing with the bill. Obviously, we'll get more time. If we look at the aims and objects of the bill, it will give us all the general intentions, what the bill seeks to do. And then there might be many specific questions that we'd like to relate to those aims and objectives. The issue of advocacy comes in there. The responsibility of members of parliament at all levels, provinces, local government, and all the relevant stakeholders in society. Advocacy work to educate members of the public in terms of their rights and also obligations and responsibilities. So I'm merely saying that we should bear in mind, let us flag the important issues that we'd like to ensure are covered. But we should also not fall into the misunderstanding that the bill that we have before us will answer each and every question that we might have. It will give us the general parameters and principles, but there are areas that can only be covered by the advocacy work that we are going to do. So the points are relevant. At this stage, we are flagging important issues, but at the same time, it would not be possible for any piece of legislation to cover each and every aspect possible. So I just want us to bear that in mind at the back of our minds as well. Any other member? Mentuli?
Thank you, Chairperson. If we can just go back to the slides on page 8, I just wanted us to look at the provision for the 5 days cooling off period and the provision for the right to return goods and receive refunds within 15 days, mainly that one. Now, I partly understand the 5 days cooling off, which in some instances, when you deal with my colleague there talked about the far, far rural areas. Lapo kalinyoni kona. In some instances, you find that those people it's difficult to reach those people, and the 5 days for them becomes very short. And even the 15 days return of goods and the receiving of return funds within 15 days is very short for a person who stays in the far rural areas and with the little money that they are having. Can't we perhaps extend the 15 days to make it more? That's my first question. I had a question on auctions, but I don't know whether it's on chapter 2 or on chapter 3. If it's on chapter 3, I'll wait for that opportunity to, because I've been reading through the piece. But let me also look at the issue of the right to choose or examine goods. We sometimes write this bill looking at learned people in the cities and so forth. But there are those people who are not protected. I'll still go back to the rural people. They're not the semi-rural, but the real rural people. How does that person examine the goods? When, in some instances, it's an old person and that person cannot even go and buy that thing. He sends somebody to do that on her behalf. How do we protect these people? Because they get all sorts of things, all sorts of, how can I put it? Izimpahla ezingasafuneki emashelfini zinikezwa bona. Now, how do we guard against that? And lastly, I've dealt with the consumer rights to return goods. Yeah, let me stop at that. I'll come back when time allows.
Thank you. Mentally, you'll get the opportunity for another rejoinder. When you say lapho kukhala inyoni khona, I see Comrade Hassman is looking at you saying that in the township they've eaten those birds. Why is it a cadillac? Comrade Hassman?
I'm just asking myself on chapter 2. But giving customers the right to information in plain and understandable language. What would that mean if we say I corner the official language are not going to play there? Then how does one understand that plain language? Which language would that be? Which language would that be? So, from the onset, I must say that we, from the committee, are going to fight the issue that we say we have abandoned. It will have to come back. You know, many of our people are being abused, even ourselves here in this committee. We are made as if we are in England. Yeah. You go to the other countries in Africa, they go to court, they speak their language. everything that they have been served in their own languages. But when you come here, it seems that we are dilly-dallying with this thing. I must say, Parliament is even advanced nowadays on the issue of official languages. So there's no detecting, you know, that we're going to ban this. I'm just pre-warning the department that this will not fly. I know that even if people are looking at expenses, they're looking at works, many of these things, we're not saying that they must be done immediately. People can actually choose to do things in phases, but we must reach to a point that we conform to our constitution. We are a constitutional country. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Comrade Sisa, I've noted you.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is around the entry of the public sector as part of the institutions that are going to be covered by this piece of legislation. Firstly, what I would like the presenters to share with us is if they could just give us examples of areas that they feel have been triggered by what one can say shoddy and unacceptable services or even products from the public sector. Throughout the presentations, more examples are mainly from or about the public sector per se, well, except maybe the SAA. But if at least just to make sure that we condition our minds, we begin to realize that probably this is how the legislation would address, you know, shoddy and bad services or products from the public sector as a whole. Thanks, Chair.
Comrade Sisa, I thank you. My apologies to some of the delegates from the provinces. Unfortunately, I do not know your names. If I point or nod at you, it's not a sign of discourtesy. It's just my weakness of not having met everybody. Over to you, sir.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. My name is Hansen Kedon from the Free State. Yeah, I read the objective of the bill, including the preamble, particularly the preamble C, bullet point 4. It says develop effective means of redress for consumers. But I think there was a submission made by the presenter to say, in order to address this specific matter that I've raised, Chair, that in situations where a supplier is found to be outside the borders of the Republic of South Africa, it will be very difficult for them to pursue the supplier on behalf of the consumer. But I suspect, Chair, it is in contradiction with the very item that I've read, develop a redress mechanism for consumers. And secondly, is that in most instances, people that are affected by these unfair practices are those illiterate ones. For instance, I read an article in one newspaper. There are these sisters of ours who used previously what is called AMBI to enlighten their faces. And then it was said, as time goes by, this would affect their skin to a situation where it will not be repaired at all. But these people, because of their level of education, they will not be exposed to these kind of discussions that we pursue, we are able to pursue inside here. And then in terms of the languages, it also makes it difficult for them. But despite the language, because they are not exposed to this kind of thing, they do not have a level of interest. So my proposal, Chair, was that beyond the language and the facilities that we are exposed to as politicians, can't the commission go to an extent of enlightening these other ones? Because besides them, there are these other shops that would sell a concoction that cures everything. And then you'll also find these sisters of ours advertising the standing at shop corners, advertising the very shops that sell this concoction. But if you ask them the kind of problems that they will be putting themselves in, they are not even aware. But what recourse can we have for this kind of people?
Thank you for highlighting some of the issues and also those concoctions, you see. At times the prescriptions of some of those items are very, I'm looking for the appropriate word. They say that use one handful. My hand is much smaller than that has many hands. So it might be two hands. So the issue that you allude to, I'm sure the department is also thinking about the practices and the results thereof. I don't see any hands in. Perhaps let us give the department a chance for a rejoinder, then we'll continue from there.
The first question was with regard to whether the bill requires business to publish the rights that consumers are given here. Currently, there is no provision like that. But what the bill does is that it gives the commission the power to develop codes of conduct in order to further facilitate the implementation of these rights. So, I mean, that can be part of a code of conduct or code of practice, to say, with industry, if you have a dispute resolution mechanism or if you want to educate consumers, you can do it in this particular way. So it gives the commission a very big advocacy role in terms of giving guidelines to industry on how to implement some of the issues. With regard to price display, the bill does deal with the display of two prices. It says that if two prices are displayed, the consumer is entitled to pay the lower price, irrespective, because that also deals, again, with bait advertising, where you would see a price displayed on a window to say it's this much. When you go inside, they say, no, it was a special from 2 weeks ago. It's not applicable anymore. That is prohibited in the field. The price you see is the price you pay. And if there's a double display, the lower price will apply. There's also issues around how they also display sale prices and so on. So there are guidelines given in the bill on how to deal with that. The 5-day cooling off period and the 10 days, I think those are issues that we haggled with in terms of business. For example, the 15 days it stays within. So that was to give business a scope because, you know, different sectors operate differently. The difficulty with this bill, because it applies across the economy, it was sometimes difficult to say one day when that sector operates differently from there are many sectors. So it stays within. So it can be one day, it can be 2 days, but it gives that scope. But I think days and times are things that are technical and can be negotiated during the hearing. But I agree that 5 days must be short. But the 5 days is important because it gives you the chance to take away the contract, to go and read it and make sure that you understand it. And if you feel that, because in direct marketing, there's a lot of pressure selling.
you know, you agree maybe because you want to get rid of the person there in your house or even on the phone, and you just agree to things. So the cooling off gives you time to go back and think whether that was a good thing to enter into that contract or not. But whether we shorten or lengthen that time, I think it's a matter for negotiation. And I think with regards to the examination of goods, it also relates to it's either whether the goods are delivered to you or whether you buy them at the store yourself, you are still given a chance to examine the goods. So the fact that the goods were delivered to you and you, the bill differentiates between accepting delivery and accepting the goods. So, for example, if you are not at home and your goods are delivered, the person at home can accept delivery but may not accept the goods, because then somebody would need to examine in terms of quality. Do they conform with the quality that you were promised or with the agreement? It also deals with goods that are bought pamphlets, where they show you the goods. You don't see the goods physical on catalogs. So the bill does say that if you buy from a sample or from a catalog, the goods must match the description. So you cannot, they cannot sell you something on a catalog and when you get the goods, you know, it's something very different. Or from a sample, but when you get the actual goods, it's different from the sample. So the bill does try to provide for instances where where the consumer is not there physically, so it can be delivered, but the consumer is then given a chance to accept the goods with regard to description and quality. The plain and understandable language, I think there is no disagreement there, but...
I'm sure everybody would like to share in the joke, but during lunchtime. Marco is answering your question, so you are busy catching you. No, you can definitely not negotiate the Makoti with a catalog.
Like I said, I think as a department we agreed that, like I said, this is a negotiated deal and some compromises were made. But I think we agree that this is something that the constitutional principles must apply. But like the honourable member has said, it relates to how it is done. And I think even the business sector was not against that requirement, but the issue was that how is it done and what would be the cost. So it's something that we felt should be debated, but I think as a policy stance and as a principle, the department does not have anything against the plain language requirement. But we also come from a department that says you want to grow business, you want to make sure that compliance requirements are not too onerous. So you wanted to balance. But if you look at the bill and look at the plain and understandable language requirements, it also gives you a very long list of what it means by plain and understandable. And I think if you read into it, to some extent you can read that it would have to be in a language that somebody understands, but it's not explicit. But I think it's something that can be debated, and you know, it is up to the committee how it wants to deal with that issue. And that is why we flagged it, because we knew it is very important. But yeah, the committee would have to tell us how to deal with it, because on our side it was quite difficult negotiating it. In terms of the public sector, a lot of the complaints we have received, for example, from municipalities was unfair billing. So consumers complained. I mean, some consumers would come in with a bill of 10 million when, you know, they only use so much electricity if you look at their normal electricity consumption. What also the bill does is that because within the public sector it's not also about quality and safety and so on, it's also about access. But access to basic goods and services, which is an international right, your basic water, your basic services and so on, it gives the commission a big advocacy role to monitor what is happening in the public sector and to be able to make recommendations to the relevant ministries of where the problem areas are. So it doesn't regulate access directly, but it gives the commission a monitoring role to be able to look. We have seen a lot of complaints from consumers about services and so on, and consumers do pay for these services. But some people are arguing that we should not regulate the public sector because some of the services are free. I wonder how many of them are free, but a lot of them we pay for them, and we have the right as consumers to the relevant services depending on that. So it's one area that we see is problematic. I don't know whether my colleagues would want to add on that, but they'll add after I finish on the questions. With regards to illiterate consumers, it is always a challenge. And the way the bill has tried to deal with that, if you look at Section 4, it tells you about, usually when we talk about complainants, you talk about the consumer themselves. But this bill broadens. It gives a very big advocacy role to different stakeholders. And I think that is what the chairperson has said, that this type of environment needs a strong advocacy kind of approach. So if you look at the type of entities or people that can approach the court or the consumer commission or the consumer tribunal to complain, it's not only a consumer. It says a person acting on their own behalf, so that would be a consumer, an authorized person acting on another person who cannot act on their own name, a person acting as a member of or an interest group, a group or class of affected persons. So there's some sort of class action there. So when even something does not affect you directly, but as a community member, as a community group, you identify that there are issues here, you have the right to take up those issues with the commission. So you have locus standi. A person acting in the public interest, and then an association acting in the interest of its members. So it broadens the types of people and entities that can approach the commission to lodge a formal complaint. So you can lodge a complaint on behalf of a certain community out of a public interest issue. Or an NGO can lodge a complaint on behalf or an association on behalf of its members. So this quite broadens and makes sure that at least those consumers who don't have a voice can get that voice through civil society groups and other interest groups. The education role is quite important, and if you look at the mandate that is given to the commission, there is a big education role, because nothing, this bill is useless if consumers out there don't know their rights, don't understand some of the issues. So I suppose the issues you have raised are quite important. Outside the borders, I mean, it's something that we thought about, and it's quite difficult because South Africa cannot impose its laws on other countries. There are issues of sovereignty and so on. So that one is a bit difficult in terms of pursuing. Unless if somebody commits that crime here in South Africa, then I suppose there are channels to pursue that person, because I think countries have agreements in terms of how they deal with people who escape to other countries. I think I'll give my colleagues a chance. My voice is going.
Thanks. Mahauta, I did tell you must save some of the gold for tomorrow as well. Whoever else from the department, Brian.
Thank you, Chair. Just to add a bit on the last issue of suppliers outside the borders. I think that precisely the reason why we looked also at the issue of strict liability, to say you extend the liability to even the retailer that you might have access to here. Obviously, the product might come from somewhere other than in South Africa, and between the retailer and the manufacturer, there might be agreements or contracts which the retailer, if he's incurred some damage losses as a result of the product that has been, you know, supplied to them, then they might be able to access be able to pursue, you know, with legal actions against us other than the consumer. Obviously, you have instances where the consumers will probably buy something by internet directly with the supplier in the United States of America or for with them. Obviously, that supplier, that this legislation will not be applicable to the supplier because it's not subject to the jurisdiction of the country. The intention is to protect the consumers here, but those that really choose to like to procure their, you know, goods or services directly with suppliers that are not, it is not really easy. They can, you know, if they have got the means, you know, pursue them, you know, in their jurisdiction, but we cannot, it's just a matter of practicality, and by law it's not easy for, you know, this legislation to have extraterritorial jurisdiction.
Thank you. Dr. Fungai, since you also want to end your living this morning.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to touch on the issue of the public sector or the state being bound by the provisions of this bill. I think what's important to recognize is that the state is a big economic player and in certain instances does provide goods and services to consumers, and therefore to the extent that the state provides those goods and services, we are saying that it therefore needs to be bound by the provisions But Chair, the other important issue that I also want to emphasize is the whole question of education and awareness raising. As Makauta has said, this bill really hinges on that aspect of education and awareness raising. Without that aspect, it's going to be very difficult for this bill to be implemented. And therefore, we do recognize the fact that you've got consumers in remote areas, you've got illiterate consumers, you've got consumers that really may never know about this bill. But it's the responsibility of each and every stakeholder, the department, parliament, civil society. And if you look at Chapter 3, talking about the institution, it actually gives the commission power to cooperate with civil society, with NGOs who work with communities to raise these issues and to educate consumers. So that's the only important thing really around this bill. Education and education. And the commission really is being given that task to go out into communities and to raise awareness and to educate consumers around that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, sir. I've noted the concrete steps, and then mentally I'll give you a chance. Okay?
No, thank you, Comrade Chair. I want just to say my observation insofar as us as government is that we are also consumers of our services that are rendered by service providers. The typical example of that, if you take your nutritional programs, we've got quite a number of service providers. And I think this type of a bill would actually enable us to check as to whether there is value for money, what is the outcome and the output that we're getting as government. You were right, Chair, when you said earlier, probably there is a much advocacy area that is actually required here, and one would actually love to see us marking on that one. But one observation that I've already made here is that earlier, before I could go through this, I was hoping that this bill would also assist a great deal those poorest of the poor that would always become recipients of items that expired in the shops and that would then be given through your NGOs, charity organizations, those type of food that perished. I mean, that food that actually is no longer in the good state, their dates are not in good standing. So I was hoping that at least this bill would actually be quite firm on that one. Those are the two observations that I would actually love to raise. Thank you.
Exactly. Thank you. Mentor.
Yeah, Bonga Chairperson. Please educate me on agreements with persons lacking legal capacity. Apart from minors and the mentally unfit persons, what does this mean? I'm asking this question because when we speak about people who have got the legal backgrounds and people who know what to do, we speak about the educated people and so on. But now when it comes to illiterate people, I still go back to the rural areas and semi-rural quarters and so forth. If you can just educate me on this one, I'll be very happy. Just explain what is it that you really mean by this. Secondly, when I read about auctions, how does this protect consumers in particular? Because here, it seems to me it just outlines how auctions should be conducted. But it doesn't tell me that how does it protect Umantuli's RDP house that is taken by Abomachonisa and they are auctioning that house. And Umantuli can't do a thing. Jobangi Umantuli Juangwan. And lastly, on lay-bys, we used to be told that the money is not refundable, and sometimes after having paid the amount, sometimes you are given 6 months or 3 months to pay. And then if you couldn't pay within that 3 months, you lose the money and you lose that particular item that you have been buying or you have laid by it, and nothing happens, or they just give you something very, very cheap and so on. If you can just explain to me how this will work now, so that I can be able to explain to Omangubeni Lekhaya, say, this is what is going to happen. Nama lay-bys, this is what is going to happen. The RPP, this is what will happen. Ngabantu abafana na nam, abangana legal background and so forth. Ngiyabonga sisa.
Mantuli siyabonga labo kalenyo. Labo isa kala. It's not yet been eaten. Good folks from the department, a chance for a rejoinder. Thereafter, we'll have to stop proceedings for the day. The House NA is sitting at 2 o'clock, NCOP, I'm not sure what time it's sitting. But we will continue tomorrow. And after we have heard all the replies from the department, you are all invited to lunch at the old assembly.
Okay. There were observations, so I'm not sure whether we need to respond to the observations. I think the only thing there with regards to charity organizations, this bill
applies to profit and non-profit organizations. So the commission would have jurisdiction over, because sometimes people can use those institutions to circumvent the law, so the bill does apply to those institutions. With regards to legal capacity, Honorable Ntuli, it does relate to minors and so on. But if you look at Section 40, when we talk about unconscionable conduct, it relates to, it goes beyond that, because then the court or the commission would be able to look at that agreement and see whether the supplier took advantage of the fact that somebody is illiterate, somebody is old, and so on, and do not understand the agreement. Because Section 40 says a person must not use physical force, coercion, undue influence, pressure, unfair tactics, or any other similar conduct. So this is very broad, to be able to capture those instances where really you can see that somebody, you know, used immoral methods to enter and took advantage. Because the unconscionable section is to deal with instances where we feel that the supplier takes advantage of the fact that somebody is illiterate, is old, and so on. We would be able to capture those issues under Section 40. So that's what it means. There was a question around auctions by machinists. This bill deals with general auctions, but if you remember, in the National Credit Act, it does provide for a process where if a consumer is in distress and they cannot afford to pay, there is a process, it regulates how those, for example, mainly relating to immovable property, how it must be disposed of. So I think the National Credit Regulator can deal with that, because that would be an auction that is part of a debt collection process, and it would not be covered in terms of this bill. It would apply to the National Credit Act. Lay-bys, as to how they work now, as far as I can remember, I would need to look at the specific section, but what I remember with lay-bys is that we said that if you lay-by something, the supplier does not have a right to, when you come for that item, to try and give you something different from what you paid for. Because what you usually say, some people would have one item and take five lay-bys for the same item. And when a consumer comes to collect, the items are not available and so on, they try to offer you something different. So this bill would outlaw that kind of practice. And in that instance, where the item that you lay by is not available and the supplier cannot give it to you, they are required to refund you with interest. But there are also penalties if you as a consumer cancel within a specific period of time. Because it has to be, we also have to be fair to the supplier who has taken the item out of access to other consumers. They could have sold that item. They put it aside for you as the consumer. So it is only fair that if you decide at some point that you don't want the item anymore, and sometimes you will find it after 3 months, 4 months, that item is not in fashion anymore, no one wants it, and the supplier has lost money. So there are penalties for instances where the consumer cancels under certain circumstances. But there are also penalties for the supplier where they cannot also meet the side of their bargain. They should refund you. I think in other instances, they refund you double, and in other instances, they refund you with interest, depending on what the circumstances are. So in that instance, we tried to balance it out in that way.
Another thing on the issue of lay-by is that what the bill seeks to achieve is to make sure that the money that is being put in for lay-by is not the supplier's money until the product, the good has been, you know, given out. In case where, for whatever reasons, the supplier goes under, then that money is protected. It seems to reinstate that money is not really accessible to the creditors of the supplier. Also on the issue of the capacity to contract. Basically, what the bill seeks to do is to reinforce some of the principles of contract law, you know, which merely says that, you know, people that are under, you know, curatorship, such as like mentally, you know, handicapped people that have been certified so by the court, cannot contract. If you as a supplier go ahead and contract with that person, then it's at your own risk, because that contract is void, and especially if those people have not really received the assistance of the people like the curator, or even the minors, if they are not emancipated, the contract can be voidable, in the sense that when he reaches age of emancipation, they may decide not to honor the contract and there's nothing much to do. It's basically a matter of putting into the consumer protection law relevant principles of contract law that we think that will need to be applied. At least they are somewhere where they are accessible other than in the general contract law.
It's your chance to hear your voice, man.
Unfortunately, my voice is so bad. Okay.
Tomorrow it will sound like a bird.
I think so. It will improve. Okay, just to clarify on the issue of mentally disabled or illiterate persons, I think the intention there in terms of the unconscionable conduct, I think this term sometimes it confuses people. I mean, people would like to know the simple meaning really of that term and how it applies to them. And I mean, maybe the simple way of clarifying it further is to maybe look at the situation where the supplier acts in bad faith, whereby the supplier actually can take an advantage of the fact that the supplier can see that this person is at a disadvantaged position. The person is not able to actually, maybe if I can take that example that OCC has given earlier on about the price displays. You walk into a store, you see that maybe the price is of those shoes is about 200 rand. And then the supplier decides that by looking at you, and the supplier decides at that moment that the price of those shoes is actually 250 or 230 rand. The supplier is actually taking an advantage, knowing that you cannot on your own now sort of defend yourself or come with something that will actually overrule the supplier's decision at that moment. So in that particular case, therefore, the supplier is acting in bad faith. And there's always also in other jurisdictions as to say, to what extent would the supplier then go in terms of bargaining powers, or when you want to bargain, you want to sell something and using some aggressive methods of selling a particular good. So where do you draw the line? Would you really say that the supplier has taken an advantage of the consumer because the consumer was at that moment at a disadvantaged position? So it becomes an issue of interpretation. But what is nice about those provisions dealing with the unconscionable conduct is that it's sort of a catch-all provision. Things that you cannot deal with in terms of other provisions in the bill, where you have to prove specific elements of the bill, then in terms of the unconscionable conduct, it deals with some of the issues, even issues relating to unfair discrimination. So it can deal with such issues. But I think the simple way of understanding the unconscionable conduct and the way it's written in the bill, it's about a supplier acting in a bad faith, taking an advantage of a person who doesn't have those bargaining powers, and the person who's in a disadvantaged position. So you're really trying to deal with that unfair situation.
Thank you very much, ma'am. I think we have done well for the day. Nobody has fallen asleep. Nobody's false teeth fell out in that process. While there's still keen interest, we will recommence with our work tomorrow at 9:30, the same venue. So until then, good folks, right now you are invited to lunch. It's in the old assembly. Dining hall is on the ground floor of this section of parliament. But just look at somebody who's familiar who might be walking in that direction. So we'll see you there. Thank you. Meeting is adjourned, folks.